This is the Tame Aperture Podcast.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Do you read me, Hal? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you. I read you. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Come on down and jump out of this shit.
You'll always have that. Sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Welcome to the Tame Aperture Podcast, where we talk all things movies from first-time directors, indie films, art house, and much, much more. Today on the podcast, we talk the 1999 dark comedy directed by Alexander Payne titled Election. The plot revolves around a student body election and satirizes politics and high school life. I'm Gabe Wienendahl, filmmaker, film instructor, and movie enthusiast, and joined, as always, by veteran podcaster, filmmaker, editor, Alan Martindale. Alan, how the hell are you?
I'm doing great. I'm super excited to see what you think about this random movie that I pulled out of my ass to review.
So random. Last time we did Paris, Texas. The time before that we did Zodiac. Totally different types of films in their own right. And then you throw a curveball at 100 miles an hour, which I didn't know was possible.
It is.
100 mile an hour curveball. Election.
Yeah, it's so I was listening to a book called Best Movie Year Ever. And it is about 1999. Let me take you back to 1999. For those who weren't there, you missed out on a stellar movie year. And I didn't even realize what a banger of a year this was. Let me just read you. This is a fraction of the films that came out in the year 1999.
This is just before you do that, can we just say here we are aging ourselves in some sense, because 99 for us was a prime year. We're the same age. So we were both either graduating high school or 18 years old. Do you know what I mean? We're just getting all nostalgic now.
It was formative. Exactly. And that's why I saw this book on Audible and I picked it up, and it was just like, I was sucked in because they don't even go over a fraction of the movies that came out and how important, not just great films, but how important a lot of these movies were culturally and formatively for people. Graduating high school, adolescents, young adults, also future filmmakers, very influential stuff that came out. So here's a list of just a small portion of the films that came out.
Love it.
Varsity Blues, Office Space, Cruel Intentions, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, The Matrix, Star Wars Episode One, Austin Powers 2, Run Lola Run, The South Park Movie, Summer of Sam, American Pie, The Blair Witch Project, Eyes Wide Shut, The Sixth Sense, American Beauty, Three Kings, Fight Club, Boys Don't Cry, Being John Malkovich, American Movie, The Insider, Dogma, Toy Story 2, The Cider House Rules, The Green Mile, Magnolia, Man on the Moon, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. That is just a fraction. And of course, the movie we're talking about today, Election.
That's pretty wild. I mean, there's a lot. It's a real mixed bag there.
It is. And there is a bunch of, there's a lot of other teen movies that came out, like 10 Things I Hate About You, that I didn't even put on the list just because they weren't big to me, but they were super influential and important for people at that time. So, I mean, there's so much more. Just go on Wikipedia or IMDb and just look at all the films that came out. If you have a couple minutes, it's pretty impressive. I didn't realize they all came out that same year.
Interesting that was your decision. Now, what's the name of this book that you read?
It's called The Best Movie Year Ever.
Wow.
Actually, no, Best Period Movie Period Year Period Ever Period.
Wow.
It's just like just listening to it, and they bring up like Three Kings. That's a sleeper movie that no one ever talks about.
That is a sleeper. Fantastic. It is a sleeper.
It's fantastic. And there's so many of those. And Election was one of those that I remember seeing this. I graduated high school. And this was marketed as an American Pie type
Yes.
You know, teen sex comedy thing. And to me, this is what makes it so interesting, because it is like, even in the tone, it feels like that's what it is. It feels like it's one of those raunchy sex comedies for teens, but it's from the adult's perspective. And that, to me, that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Because this is how it would be for adults. You know, this is like it is written from an adult perspective, and it apologizes for all the terrible decisions these adults are making in this film. And it's like sweeping them. It's really fascinating. So that's why I think there's a lot more going on than people realize when they watch this movie. So why I wanted to watch it.
That's a great introduction into why. And it got me thinking, man, I originally was like, this is a 30-minute podcast, Alan.
I know, me too.
In my head, usually we go about an hour or so. Yeah, I was like, this one's 30 minutes. And then you come out with this hell of a sell. You just upselled everything. And come out and you're like, hey, I got, and you name all these movies. And then, to be honest, amongst those movies, you threw an Election. Now we'll get into it. But just before we get into Election, I just want to highlight what you're saying, which is, think of these movies. Now, love them or hate them or for whatever it's worth, you're right here. Okay, we got the return of Star Wars as a franchise.
Right.
So love it or hate it, Phantom Menace, whatever. Right. I don't care.
But nothing was bigger at that point.
Huge, dude.
And The Matrix is The Matrix.
The Matrix?
Are you kidding me?
Sense?
Fight Club?
Fight Club? And I know a lot of people love The Mummy.
The Mummy. I didn't even mention The Mummy.
I think you said American Beauty.
Yes.
Which I want to say won an Oscar. I can't remember.
I think it won Best Picture.
I think it did.
Yeah.
So, and then now we have Kevin, and we can't talk about American Beauty because Kevin Spacey's been canceled. Yeah. But
there was one more movie on there that I did want to mention. And this is a film that I actually would love to do on this podcast to cover. And it's called American Movie. Have you ever heard of it?
American Movie? I have not heard of this.
It's a documentary about, it's one of the best, it's rated as one of the best documentaries ever made. It's just about this weird trailer park dude trying to make a horror film, basically, is what it is.
I'm already intrigued by the premise.
It's bizarre. It's weird. It's really, really, it's interesting. So that's what I'm going to put on the list. For some point, we have to cover
that. It feels like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but for documentaries?
A little bit. It's more like this guy and just his own problems keep getting in his own way. And like the cast of characters, his friends and relatives who help him try and make this movie, trying to make his dream come true. And
I'm so intrigued right now.
It's interesting. It's really interesting.
We're doing that one at some point.
Yeah, it's great.
I have not even heard of this documentary. So
many sleepers came out of 1999.
And then you jump back the other direction. You look at, and once again, love it or hate it, you have these films culturally, Austin Powers.
Yeah.
Like The Spy Who Shagged Me. Like that came out too. So whether you like them or you don't, I mean, I waited 27 hours in line for Phantom Menace. Kiss my ass. I don't care.
Okay, wait, hold on. Real quick. This is another sidebar. So I was not a huge Star Wars fan at the time. I really became a fan later on, when I really started to dive into movies. What was your reaction seeing the Phantom Menace?
Well, here's what everyone does, I think, with Phantom Menace. And I'm not lying. This was a 33rd South and State Street, Century 16. You're aware of it. And I don't know the exact number, 2,000 to 3,000 people in the parking lot.
Oh, my God.
This is the other cool thing about 99, dude. It's pre-internet. Yep. It's pre-reservation. You wanted that ticket? You sat your ass down for a day and a half in a tent in the parking lot to get that ticket.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And we did. Dude, guy pulls up. We're like 30th out of 2,000 people in line, me and my buddies. Dude pulls up behind us. there's a parking lot still, but people are lined up in a line. And just outside the line, an RV pulls up, he pulls a projector screen down, and we watch the trilogy with 2,000 people. In terms of movie communal watching. It was the greatest experience of my life in terms of that. Like, it was fantastic.
Absolutely.
When do you get an experience like that?
Never again.
Dude, people dressed up. Obviously, we got Darth Mauls. We got Qui-Gons. We got Jedis, lightsabers, and people just going nutty. Now, admittedly, I look like I do now. Like, I had a hat and a shirt on.
Right.
Like, I did not. And then I burned one half of my face because the sun was setting.
Yeah.
And you're 18, so you don't think about sunscreen. But, and I'm obviously fair skinned, so it was not a good time the next day. However, we got the tickets, and your question is, so I walked out going, yeah, that was the best movie ever. And to be honest, I still don't hate The Phantom Menace. I know there's a lot of shit on it, and people are like, Phantom Menace. Like, to be honest, as an origin story, now, the execution, there were things, but, like, ultimately, I was fine with it, and I stick by that.
Ringing endorsement. Ringing endorsement. Well, have you ever seen another documentary called The People versus George Lucas?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that one.
Fantastic. There's this one fan who talks about seeing The Phantom Menace. And he was like, well, the reaction at first, we were all like, no, it was good. I mean, I'm going to go see it again, but it was good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Almost trying to apologize for it. And so I was just wondering if that was kind of your feeling of it afterwards.
Maybe, but I was probably more excited about it. I was probably like, yes. I was like, that was awesome.
Yeah.
And later going, I mean, it's fine.
But
I'm not a hater on it, though. Like, people come out now and they're like, it's the worst. It's not. Shut the hell up. You don't know what you're talking about.
It's pretty bad. That one's pretty bad. That trilogy got better as they went on.
It got better, for sure. But I don't know how you don't, because you have to start somewhere.
That's true.
It's hard to live up. You got to realize, too, it's hard to live up to that cultural impact from the first one, right? So that's a tough test. Although, in a movie theater, I've never been in... Two things: a more rowdy environment in a movie theater when you saw Lucasfilm come up at the beginning banner.
I can't even imagine.
Dude, it felt like I was at a jazz game.
And then when the crawl, like...
The crawl comes up, like, we're just hearing cheering. And then, and admittedly, and the music of that film is great, by the way. I don't care what you say. The music is awesome. And when Darth Maul appears and ready to fight the two, and you hear the music, and the crowd went fucking nuts, dude. So if you're talking about a scene, like, anyone can say what they want about the movie, but there's a scene in that movie, and we all know what it is, when he gets, and he's appearing, he's going to fight the two Jedis, and he does the dual lightsaber. But in theater, amongst, 400 people, it felt like 4,000 people.
Yeah, that's amazing. An experience I don't know if I'll ever get.
It's vividly imprinted on my mind, because you're right. I don't think we'll never get back to that place in theaters where you'll feel something like that.
Right. Because this was the crazy first time that a big franchise was kind of resurrected like that. Now it happens all the time. Now they milk it, and it's expected, and all that kind of stuff is just not, it'll never be novel again. It'll never be exciting, because now we're just,
that's a great point. It really is. Like, there had been such a gap between.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting point. So anyway, 99's a great year. I mean, now we're walking down memory lane. Now, when I thought of 99, I didn't think of election, but obviously you jumped in. So really, what do you remember watching it when it came out?
Yes. Yes, I do. Well, I watched it on video, actually, not even DVD. I watched it on a videotape.
VHS, baby.
Somewhere, and there was a VCR, and election was there, and I was like, oh yeah, this looked cool. Like, I liked American Pie. I thought it was funny. And so I put it in, and I was like, oh well, this is different. This is way different and way better, in my opinion, than American Pie or any movie like that. Like, to me, this is just a whole other level. And there are two things. I don't know if election had been released in any other year, if it would have gotten more attention. It certainly, I think, was drowned out by all the great stuff coming out. And I also don't know if Matthew Broderick, they cast him in this because it was like having Ferris Bueller grown up. That's why they chose him. That's why Alex chose him, which is, I think, really cool.
It's a great, it's a Alexander Payne. That's a great strategy.
I mean, so have you ever taught high school? You're a teacher. I know you teach at the college.
Just college, no high school, fortunately.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know what your high school experience was like, but for me, he just knocked everything out of the park from the principal and how he's so self-important and feels like a general or a CEO or something, to the teach, like even Matthew Broderick, when he's teaching classes, a good teacher speaks like him, the same cadence and the same, you know, just every little thing. It felt so legitimate, like being right back in high school. And even the kids, I'm sure you had people like this, the overachiever. Just like, I could not stand Reese Witherspoon when she was on the screen, every frame she was on the screen, because I hated that character so much. She just bugged the shit out of me. So he just, I don't know how he was able to get these, I don't want to call them tropes, these.
I mean, they are stereotypes.
They are stereotypes, but they don't feel like stereotypes. Like, they don't feel like it's a trope. Like, it feels legitimate.
It feels in a natural atmosphere. Like, it feels like, oh, that does, it doesn't feel forced or contrived. It's like, here's some stereotypes, but like, this is
right.
It's not like we're trying to, I know exactly what you're saying. We're not trying to hit the stereotype. It just feels too natural too.
It doesn't feel ham-fisted at all. Yes. It feels actually like genuine. So for like, to me, just the direction, the editing in this, I cannot sing its praises enough. So many of the jokes and so many of the punchlines land because of how it's cut together. And it is just, to me, just brilliant. And I'm sure a lot of that wasn't done in the editing room. I'm sure a lot of that was planned in the screenplay. And as, you know, he's planning the shots and everything. But to me, it just like, oh, this is what I love about editing. The juxtaposition of two images, two scenes, two ideas can just create a whole emotion in people. And this is why I'm a geek about it. So I just love it, man. It's a strange, weird little movie.
Well, I always find this interesting, and you start bringing up editing, and obviously as an editor, and both of us really leaning into that discipline in our own work. And I always find it interesting who did edit these. And obviously I always also find it interesting that, you know, you look at Alexander Payne, who's the writer director of Election, and he's done other movies, and there are other movies that I've actually, the ones I've seen, I've actually enjoyed. I haven't seen all his work. And he is the same editor every time. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. Kevin Tent is his editor. And I always find that relationship interesting. That's a lot of trust, right? Because you're saying, and you're talking about this juxtaposition and how the piece was put together. And it's like, there's a reason editors and directors are so closely knit, typically.
Yep.
You look at people like, you know, Marty Scorsese. I call him Marty. Just me and Marty.
That's because you're tight with him. So
Yeah. and Schoonmaker, you know, like, but there's always like, or like, you know, before she passed away, Sally Menke and Quentin Tarantino, like, directors always, they find an editor and they don't let him go.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, you know, they always say that there are technically three different phases of writing on a film, the screenplay, the direction, and the editing. But if you think about it, directors don't always work with the same writer. A lot of the times they'll work with writers repeatedly, but they don't always work with the same writer. But they do tend, the really good ones do tend to find a good editor and work exclusively with them. So it's
and
interesting.
Spielberg does it too.
Yep.
Everyone has their go-to editor. Yeah, you're right. That is interesting. There's those, you know, we always hear that in the theory of storytelling and narrative and film. It's always like, oh yeah, there's these three processes that,
right.
Not that they're all important, and everyone's bringing some kind of artistry to it. Like, you look at just, you know, I'm always kind of marveled by like hair and makeup and their skill and their talent when it comes to especially like prosthetics or special effects, things like that. But you're right, those three things, and they don't let editors go. So there's a reason for that. And with this, like, yeah, there's a, it's really nicely edited. I'm actually you said something there that kind of provoked a thought in me. You said, okay, it was released in 99. We've already talked about how 99, and you've introduced this idea of all these great movies, which makes a lot of sense to me. It's so interesting too, because it almost feels in the plot of this story, there is foreshadowing culturally. Because if you look at 2000, there's a big election debacle, right? Or debate or scandal or however you want to label it, right? With Bush Gore. This thing's in that regard, it's freaking Nostradamus in some sense.
And not only that, there was a third party, Ralph Nader at that time, there was a third party just kind of trying to disrupt the system. So exactly. It's very strange. And this is actually based on a book. So it's not like they saw what was coming up and wrote a film about it and created it in time. I mean, that's impossible to do, but it's actually written or based on a book that was written even before. So it's crazy. The zeitgeist and what was going on then.
I don't know. I'm just speculating from a marketing perspective. Point. Like, we had this real thing happen in our political landscape here, right? And now you have this fun kind of witty comedy. So
that's interesting.
It came out a year too early is what I'm saying.
I think you're right. I'm trying to find what month it came out. I can't find it offhand, but that's interesting. Yeah, that's a good point.
Go ahead.
With the themes, I mean, it's stuff we deal with today, you know, that's why, you know, people have always been making terrible decisions and people have always been trying to justify it, you know, and it's interesting to see. I don't know about you. When I was in high school, the teachers didn't seem to be people to me. They were just like authority figures who had their shit together and like they knew everything. And it's weird to see, especially me watching this just coming out of high school, to see like they actually are human beings who have problems and they hate some of their students. They like some of their other students. They have grudges, you know, like it's weird to view them as human beings. And that, to me, that was another cool thing that it just hit me at the right time in my life. And it helped me just view the world differently because you never see that. You never see that.
Yeah, that's true. And in high, you know, my experience was pretty similar, but also there was always, what was interesting was there was always in high school, there was always one or two, I can name them. I won't, but there was one or two that were actually felt real. So like most of the felt like bots.
Yes.
And then I have them and I won't name them, but like there was two of them specifically that I'm like, oh, those are real people and they're cool and they're relatable. And you know what I mean? Like 100%. there was a thing there that you could at least talk to them and know that they were a real person, but I don't think you're wrong. I think it feels like mostly they're bots. I feel like that sometimes in my own college courses, like, am I just a bot here? Just speaking.
That sequence where it's Tammy's, Tracy's voiceover, and she's talking about how Mr. McAllister, Matthew Broderick, is teaching the same thing year in and year out. And it's just like a constant dissolve montage of him teaching the three government.
And it's just like different shirt, different sport coat.
Exactly. But it's basically the same thing.
Same thing.
And that's kind of how I viewed my teachers then, you know, like they're just teaching the same shit over and over. And they're not going to remember us 2 years from now. And so it's interesting to see them when like you see them as human beings. Very flawed human beings at that, but it's just a really cool turn.
No, that is a good point of view to take on. And for me on this movie, Alan, obviously a little surprised, like, oh, this seems like a little bit out of our pocket, but like, right. Okay, right. This is not what. And then I see the MTV Productions banner come up.
I know, yeah.
And I'm like, there's one of two ways this is gonna go. Either I'm gonna kind of just laugh because it's fun and silly, or it's going to be an MTV production.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And that's not a knock, because we got to realize, throwing it back for those that don't know, like MTV was a huge, it was
massive.
Dude, it was like the world in 98, 99. Like that was huge.
It defined our generation.
100%. It can't go understated, I think. I just mean that. It's the same thing as like what you see kids with like on YouTube today, and the cultural impact that it's hitting with kids, younger kids, and you like MTV was the thing, dude.
It was,
as you know. But I saw that banner and I was like, uh-oh. It's not in the middle. It's not like, oh, it'll be okay. It's either it's gonna be funny and I'm gonna like
it's gonna be like Beavis and Butthead, or it's gonna
I'm gonna like that South Park-y Beavis and Butthead kind of like MTV generational fun.
Or it's gonna be Hughes Bigelow.
Or 100%. You just
which is another 1999 movie, by the way.
Okay, good to know, because I only saw it once and don't need to see it again. So
awful.
My point being is because I don't remember it well enough. It wasn't really in my pocket of movies in 99. So I was like, what are we getting into here? I remember seeing it, but that's 24 years ago. So I didn't really remember a lot. Where I actually had the most recollection was on syndication on like TBS.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
This is pre-internet. This is so later, like 2002, 2000, not pre-internet, but pre-YouTube is what I mean. Like just really driving home all the video online. So I remember seeing it on like TBS syndication. And then, of course, it's edited.
Right.
So it's not as good, right?
Right.
But that's how I recollect it. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's who it is. And so rewatching it, I was like, what do we get into? And you're right. Like, we'll get into some more detail. But walking away going, yeah, there's a lot of things going on here.
Yeah.
You know, and he introduces morality and ethics and those kind of things in a fun way. Through the lens of a high school environment.
It almost like it's a film that doesn't, I don't think anyone knew what to do with it or what to make of it. Cause it's not an American Pie sex comedy. It's not like an adult oriented dark comedy. Like what is it? It's in the middle, you know? So I don't know. It almost feels like it was, it's going to sound weird, ahead of its time and also very much a product of its time. Is how it feels to me. And so it's just a weird, I don't know. That's why I when I was listening to that book and it came up, I was like, well, we got to talk about this one.
Yeah. And that's an interesting way to position it, because I feel like that's probably a pretty accurate place for this film to be. And I don't think they knew what to do with it either. Like looking back on it now though, and having rewatched it, Is it this film that is so impactful that it's got me thinking for days? No.
Right.
But is it put together, like you said, in a different way outside of the sex comedy? Yeah. It's got more intellect than that.
It shows the consequences of living your life as if it's a sex comedy. It really does.
That's fair. That's fair.
It really does.
So let me ask you this. What about in terms of the story? There's a couple things I loved about just the bookends of how it's all put together. But is there anything that stands out here in the film about, and we're talking story or characters, things that stood out, a specific character, part of the story that resonated? What really did you walk away with and go, hey, that makes a lot of sense, or that's really dumb?
So here's the thing. There's a lot going on. Like you just said, there's a lot going on in this movie. I almost don't even want to dive in to the themes and the subtext. I almost just want to leave it what it is and enjoy it for its surface level. Cause I really do love it. It, like you said, like this isn't one of my favorite movies of all time that I'm going to put on my list, but I love everything about it. That said, I think my favorite part of this thing is Paul, who's played by Chris Klein. He is like if a dog was a human being, a loyal dog was a human being. And I just, the way he plays just this dumb idiot who's so naive and non-judgmental and just like, to me, he's my favorite part of the whole film. And every time he's on screen, I'm laughing.
Yeah, he's great. He definitely embodies that lovable dog-like high school kid.
So true. Just like,
just so naive to the world.
Yes. Has no idea. Just has no idea.
doesn't, which brings me to a particular scene. He's going up against Tracy in the election, the school election, student body government.
Yeah, we should probably mention it's a student election.
Yes, at a high school in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yes.
And I loved that, by the way. It doesn't become a huge part to the story or the atmosphere necessarily, but I just like that they located it in a place that's just kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. You know? It's just America.
Yeah. Cause now you've positioned it where there's no leniency either way. You know, when you look at America, and not to get into politics, but you have kind of East Coast and West Coast and Middle America, and they just kind of put it in this place where it doesn't become a huge character in the story.
Right.
And just kind of sets it in a place where there's relatability across the board.
Yep.
And Paul is kind of thrown into the mix and in the election, and is so dog-like and so characteristically naive and nice that he doesn't even vote. He causes the problem, is what I mean.
Exactly.
There is a the end game is that he doesn't vote for himself as president. So now he votes for the opposing team. And that ends up being
to win, yeah.
The downfall for the rest of the plot. So
it's, and that's why I just, it's everything about him is just, you want me to run? Okay, I'll run. Oh, I want, you know, like it's just, he's so dumb and friendly and innocent. And it's just, you can't not laugh at him. And it's, I mean, he's been in other movies. I mean, he hasn't done much lately, but he was in American Pie, obviously. And he was a little bit more intelligent in that movie. But to me, it just feels like this was the role he was meant to play. Chris Klein was meant to play this guy.
This guy. Yeah. No, 100%. I know you said you don't, there's just so much going on here in terms of themes.
I know.
So we won't need to, and I agree, like kind of in some sense, let it be what it is.
Right.
But there's so many themes here. I think he does a great job, you know, Alexander Payne, at tying all those themes together. Because you're talking about ambition, you're talking about power, morality, ethics. Like, yep. There's just so many leadership, authority. Like, I could just keep going. There's so many things here.
But and I think the fact that the people running are not at all qualified to have any sort of power.
Yes.
I think that's obviously a very pretty clear comment.
This is a clear subtext to a bigger picture across the board politically.
And in the end, it doesn't matter to anybody.
That's the bigger takeaway.
Yeah.
Is that everyone's fighting and clawing and trying to outmaneuver. Not everyone. There's always, like you said, it's Paul. Yeah.
Right.
He's just doing his thing.
Yeah.
But everyone else has an agenda.
Yep.
And and then you're right. At the end, it doesn't matter.
And no one, not one single person is doing it to better the school.
No one is doing it for the betterment of the whole.
They're doing it for them.
It's all personal.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you like, what were your thoughts? Let's talk about Tracy, who's played by Reese Witherspoon. That character, though, let's break that down a little bit.
I don't know if it was the direction or if it was just her insane acting ability, but she embodied that role so well, because she's usually like she always played the nice girl, the innocent girl. And so for her to really like just dive into that character, I hated every second she was on screen.
I hated her. This is a character thing. This is obviously not a person.
Not
Reese attack on Reese Witherspoon. Right. I think she's a great actor, but when we're breaking down the character, I agree. Every time I'm like, I hate this little, you know what? Like, I hate her. Like, because you know they're out there.
Yeah,
I'm just not down with it. You
We've
know?
All
and
known then, him.
And here's where what's interesting about that character to me, and I did not like her as you mentioned, and I felt bad for her too.
I think that is the beauty of this movie. Like, it's not black and white. It's
because I'm looking more at the environment. If I was really breaking down, we always get a little deep in some way. So I'm going to take it there again. If once again, we know this is a movie, so it's not real. But right. In her environment as a character, I felt bad for her because she grew up in a really weird environment.
Right.
Where there was this additional pressure. First off, no kind of parental figure necessarily. Her mom's there, her dad, who knows? But her mom's really weird and pressures her into like certain things. Like there's a scene at the beginning where like they would talk about her mom would write letters to successful women. Like Connie Chung, by the way, that's a reference to
No one will know now,
but when we were in high school, she was a huge reporter, yep. Journalist. So, but I mean, her mom would write letters to these successful women in hopes of getting some kind of information back from them on how her daughter can be successful. That's yep. a weird pressure to live up to.
And she even mentions it in the voiceover. She says, my mom just wants me to be great and do all the things she wasn't able to do.
So you don't have a dad at home and your mom's a psycho.
Yes.
So that's what I mean in the sympathy is like, okay, I do. I mean, she was a shitty little person. Don't get me wrong.
Right, right.
But I also was like, I kind of feel bad because if she's a 16, 17-year-old kid, like that's kind of a shitty environment to live in.
And I think that's the beauty of this is she does shitty things. She's really annoying and awful, but you can also feel empathy for her. And that's not an easy thing to do. Most films, it's black or white. They're good or bad, you know, good guy, bad guy. But and that's what I really admire about this movie is there's just so much more going on. If you just look surface level, yeah, it just looks.
Alan, what's interesting about that, too, is that it's and now here we go again. Just walking down Alexander, rolling out the red carpet for Alexander Payne.
I know. That's ridiculous.
Like
man.
Last time it was David Fincher, right?
Yeah.
And this time it's just like, now they're great. They're geniuses. But when you really start breaking it down, not only is Tracy's character that way, but also Matthew Broderick, his yep. character's that way too.
Yep.
There's a sympathy level for him.
Yep.
But also a hatred.
Yes.
That contrast is crazy. That's crazy because you're right. Most characters are going to be set up in a black and white sense that it's like one or the other.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And by the way, as we're walking down the we're all bowing now to Alexander Payne. but think about it even deeper because when you take that and then you go, oh, what he's also not only introduced to us as a topic for the film, which is morality and ethics. So it's not like he's just going to talk about it. He's going to build the characters in a way that makes you think about those two things.
Yep.
We're doing now. Yep. You know what I mean? Like that is not an easy thing to do. I don't think
it's really difficult. And that's why. So I always try and watch if I can stomach it. I always try and watch whatever movie we're going to cover. I try to watch it more than once, like I usually twice. And so on my...
Like Look Who's Knocking at My Door by Martin Scorsese.
Oh, yeah. I watched that 50 times. No,
you threw that in at least a dozen times.
I can't do it. But so on this
play
one...
Play Misty for me.
Oh, God. Or the Willem Dafoe one. I can't even remember what that was called. His first role.
Loveless.
The Loveless, that's right. Yeah. Nah, no, I'm
which,
not going to watch it.
For me, the movie apologist was like, it's all right.
It's fine.
Alan hated it so bad.
I love Willem Dafoe, too, so it takes a lot for
that's
me.
That's a lot, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you, but you were
totally good.
You watched the movies in preparation.
So I watched it, and then
multiple times.
After I was like you. I was like, I love this movie. I don't know if I can say a ton about it, though. So it might be a short podcast.
Yeah.
But I just know I like it. So I'll just say the things I like. But on my second watch, there's a lot more going on. There's so much foreshadowing in the littlest, tiniest things. First thing Matthew Broderick does, he's throwing stuff in the garbage. And he misses with the Chinese food, which sets up the whole problem for him. And the janitor is the one who knocks him out later.
He's in the faculty lounge. He gets upset because there's no room in the fridge for his lunch. Let's keep that in mind. right?
Exactly, exactly.
His lunch. So then he pulls a, so now he pulls a trash can. This is what I mean by the subtext. He pulls the trash can over and clears out other people's stuff.
Yep.
The gall.
Exactly, exactly.
So he throws, and then he misses one. Chinese food goes all over the floor, and guess who spots it? The janitor. He's like, this dude's just throwing food all over the floor for me to pick up later.
He knows exactly what this dude's doing. Like he reads it exactly. And later on, when Matthew Broderick's character, when they're doing the vote count, he doesn't want Tracy to win because he can't stand her. So he throws two votes away, which that were for her, meaning that Paul wins. So he cheats for her. And the janitor's the one who finds it in the garbage.
Finds the two in the garbage and reports it to the principal.
Exactly. But also, there's also the next thing he does after that, he's walking down the hallway. This is the very beginning of the movie. He's walking down the hallway and Tracy set up her like her little booth to get signatures so she can be on the ballot. And he talks to her for a second. He walks past her and there's some paper on the ground and he picks it up and throws it in the garbage. It's just little things like that that I noticed on my second watch. He's always drinking Pepsi, And that's an important thing later because Tracy Trent, she explains to him that Coca-Cola is the most popular drink in the country. But
because even though they're number one, they just advertise more than anybody.
Exactly. Because
she's trying to do for her campaign.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, but throughout the whole movie, he only drinks Pepsi, even up to the very end, he's drinking a Pepsi that he ends up throwing on the limo that she's riding in at the very last shot. Anyway. So there's just little things like that throughout. Like it just,
now that we're talking about this more, this is what happens every damn time.
Every time.
And you're talking about this and I'm thinking, the layers here are pretty deep.
Yeah. You're not getting
Alexander Payne deserves props because
exactly.
I didn't know that election was the inception of like sex comedies.
Exactly.
Because now I'm thinking of it like, because even, and I'll restate it here. This is a repetitious statement again, because I already said it. But if you think about the fact that he pulled a garbage can over to the fridge, it's like me.
Right. That's a very.
Like even that movement. What I mean is that literal statement, which everyone will just watch this movie and go, he's saying I'm more important than whatever's in who's ever put other things in the fridge. My space, it matters more than the other.
Exactly.
Which by the way, is a whole premise and a whole overcast of the film.
It is. It is.
So I'm just saying, like, now that I'm thinking, Alexander Payne made the inception of sex comedies.
He really did. He absolutely did. Because if you read that scene correctly, like you just did, it explains everything.
I'm learning something from Alexander Payne here. One scene, he told the whole story.
He did.
Now we wanted more, which was great, and he built into that. But like one scene tells his whole theme. That's crazy, dude.
It is. It's insane. Just like, and we've missed a very important plot point here to where Mr. McAllister, played by Matthew Broderick, his best friend is a teacher at the school as well. And yes,
this is a key point here.
Very big point.
This takes us down a whole nother road, dude.
Well, exactly. Well, this I think explains a lot more about Matthew Broderick's character as well. Mr. McAllister's best friend is named Dave. He's a teacher at the school. Dave ends up having an affair with Tracy. And this is...
Can I say this, Alan?
Yeah.
What's interesting about how he presents this idea, he doesn't do it in, and I hate this, this doesn't mean to come off the wrong way. It's not in a disturbing way in the sense that it's like, you're not physically seeing things
or
that kind of thing. Obviously it's disturbing and you never really know, and not to condone any of it.
Right.
You never really know. Did they actually have an affair? It was just like, was it more I mean, it's kind of there. I mean, it's just up for interpretation is all.
Right, right. But I think...
But either, I mean, either... Now negate all that, because either way, it's wrong.
It is very wrong. And and Matthew Broderick, the way he views this, he knows it's wrong. He tells Dave it's wrong. But ultimately, the way he views Tracy from now on is not that Dave did something wrong. Because, okay, let's say this. Dave ended up, it comes out, he gets fired. And he's lucky he's not in jail. That's even explicitly stated. He's lucky he's not in jail. And so, but
Matthew, which now we hate Dave.
Now we hate Dave, exactly. But Matthew Broderick doesn't view it as Dave did something wrong. He views it as Tracy took away my friend.
Yeah.
And that's why he hates Tracy. So that's my point, is that this explains more about
his character. Yeah. That which also lends itself more into the thematic approach to the story, which, and I'm making this assumption, Alexander Payne sat down and said, I want to tell a movie or write a movie about morals and ethics.
100%.
And that was his whole gateway into what he's done here.
And I'm going to do it through the guys, the viewpoint of a sex comedy.
Yeah.
In high school.
In high school.
Like, what is
that? That is great. I love that. So do we kind of talked about Tracy. There's kind of we don't like her, but also we sympathize.
Right.
What about Matthew Broderick's character? What's the takeaway there from him? Because there's some complexities going on there, I think.
I think everyone is their own main character in their own story, right, in life. And this is on full display here. He views being fired and having his wife divorce him because of an affair he ended up having.
By the way, with his friend who he...
With Dave's wife. Tracy took Dave away from me, but also I'm going to sleep with Dave's wife.
Like, yes, exactly.
Give me a break.
So, like, once again, we're back in this ethical, moral dilemma.
But so he also, he basically, he gets fired. Matthew Broderick gets fired. His wife leaves him. He is basically in exile. He's shunned. And this is like one of they mentioned that it's almost like it went viral. It's one of the first stories to go viral, where it's one of those things that people would email to each other and be like, can you believe that this teacher cheated to have this poor innocent girl lose the election at the school? And he ends up framing it as, oh, I went to New York City and now I have this exciting life that's amazing. And it's because he's the main character in his own story. But really, that's not what happened. He lives in destitution and he's like a borderline volunteer a tour guide at a museum.
And there's a weird thing with Dave's character where similar to Tracy, I sympathize, but also hate him.
Yes. Yes.
So you're 100% right. And he lives his own story, which is great. And his story. And when you see that, what I love about what you're saying there is that when you're watching this movie, you go, oh, it's successful. Dave is a success.
Right.
But if you just think about it in the way that you kind of laid it out in the context, you're like, oh yeah, he is living his own story. So in his head, he's a success. But if you really take a step back, he's not doing great.
He's not. He's not at all.
He's not doing bad, but he's not doing great.
Right.
I mean, he's not in Nally, you know, hitting eight balls. But like,
right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But he lives in a little tiny apartment in like below a basement, basically, where his bathroom
even that filming, by the way. You start to develop, okay, they're in a 400 square foot apartment, and then the coming out of the apartment is like crawling out of the space.
Like a rat coming out of the
rat. Exactly. A rat emerging from the sewer.
That's what it was like. So, I mean, that's my takeaway from him. I just think, here's the thing, Matthew Broderick, I don't have anything against him. I don't think he's a bad actor. I just don't think he would be where he is today without Ferris Bueller.
Well, look, let's not get sidetracked. You're going to sidetrack me on Ferris Bueller. And you're going to sidetrack me on John Hughes, who I think is one of the most incredible writers.
Yes.
Ever.
Yep.
Okay. I said it, but you're right. I think there is something, but I think that goes, there's some attributes that could go to John Hughes there, which is like,
100%.
You know, like Matthew Broderick's great. I'm not taking away. And he may actually meet, and I don't know for sure, but he may be more well-suited for Broadway theatrical stuff.
I think he is, yeah.
And he does a lot of that and is very successful. And I like him as an actor. I don't think there's, I'm not throwing any shade at, giving him his flowers, as the kids say.
Right.
But you're right. I don't know that, you know, I mean, if he doesn't land Ferris, I mean, Ferris is such an iconic role and the writing in that's so good.
Still to this day, I mean, when Ferris...
It's still, Alan, it's, if you watch it and really break it down, it's still relevant today for high school kids.
It absolutely is. It came out 38 years ago. Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Any high school kid today that watched that movie in some way, shape, or form, whether it's through Cameron or Ferris, I'm just saying, like, they could, any of them, you resonate 30 years later. So you're right, though. Like in his, and so I like it. But here's the thing about him, too, is he still demands interest. So every time he's on screen, I'm, even hate him or love him. Sometimes you go, this guy's not even, let me give you a quick, horrible example.
Okay.
I watch Aquaman. I start Aquaman 2 with my son. He's 11. He wants to watch it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is how bad the acting was. We're 10 minutes in. My son goes, we're done. This is not a fabrication. He looks at me and goes, I didn't believe it.
That is amazing.
Because he was watching Jay, and I, once again, not really knock on Jason Momoa. I actually like him.
Right.
But his acting in that particular movie was atrocious.
That's hilarious.
So the comparable there is just saying, at least, even if you don't love Matthew Broderick, at least he'll demand your attention while he's acting.
I mean, I guess. See, I don't agree. Like,
okay.
So here's my point. He came out.
So you're saying he's like Jason Momoa, basically.
No, not. I think Jason Momoa, just because
it could be better.
Stature is going to command attention on screen. But
his physical presence.
Exactly. Like, you're going to remember him. Matthew Broderick, 38 years later, he's still Ferris Bueller to us.
Okay, so for you, it's more the attachment to a particular
character. I think if he hadn't gotten that role, but the rest of his career stayed the exact same, I think he would be, oh, that guy. He's that guy that's in that one movie. You know, I think he would be.
I don't think we're disagreeing there, because I actually, once again, I fall back on the fact that Ferris is just such a great written script. Like, it's John Hughes is, once again, I love John Hughes, so I don't know what else to say.
Right.
So, like, no, but I can't disagree with you, is my point.
But, and that's why I don't, usually when he's in something, it's like, okay, like Cable Guy, could have put anyone in that role.
That's fair, though, because at that point, though, you got Jim Carrey.
Right.
Is a comedic genius.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that.
But you don't have to. It's fine. But for me, when I look at what he can do, it comedically is.
Chris Farley was actually going to be the Cable Guy before he died. I don't know.
And Chris Farley would also, I think, work in that role.
I think that'd be. I would have loved to see.
But I think there's only a handful of guys or people that could actually do that.
I agree. Know?
And Jim Carrey's one, and Chris Farley would be in one too.
I agree. But my point is, in this movie, Matthew Broderick is perfect. He fits the
character.
Again, I'm going to praise Alexander Payne and whoever's casting director.
I mean, we're rolling out the red carpet, dude.
The casting is just immaculate. It's perfectly done in this, because Matthew Broderick has enough of that likability that you forget that we're seeing it through his side. He becomes the main character to us. He becomes the protagonist to us because he's got that likability. If you get someone else who's not quite that likable, we see right through it, and we see exactly what is going on. And I think Alexander Payne doesn't want that. I think he wants it to be hidden under layers. That's just my interpretation.
I think that's a fair point, because this is, once again, a horrible example. Just like I prefaced the Jason Momoa as a horrible example. So I'm also prefacing this one as a horrible example.
Well, I thought this one was a great example.
I think you're right, though. And I think it, like, if you put in this horrible example, Liam Neeson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It doesn't work, because there's no sympathy in terms of the character.
Right. Right. Right.
So now we just hate him forever.
Exactly.
And there is no redeeming factor.
Right.
Because the character or the actor doesn't lend itself.
Or even like Edward Norton. It's not this. He's got that nice guy thing. It's still, it's not going to play that way.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. So basically what we're saying with Election, now there's so many things we could keep. There really is.
Yeah, I know.
What we're doing now over the last few podcasts is we're basically creating a Hall of Fame.
True.
So if you walk down the Tame Aperture Hall of Fame, we have David Fincher and Alexander Payne. So
the problem is we already have our Mount Rushmore, and you can only have four people on Mount Rushmore.
Those are actors, though.
That's true. Those are actors.
We got Jack Nicholson. A few others.
Denzel, I think. Denzel was on there. I can't remember who they were. But
Gene Hackman wasn't on there, but I think he was like a fifth, have been carved.
Yeah. We'll have to go back through that and see. But the Hall of Fame, like that you have a little bit more room now.
We have a little more we've given ourselves. Well, are we raising these jerseys to the rafters? And I think right now, the way we talk, both Fincher and Payne are up there.
Fincher's definitely up there. Payne, I'm going to have to go back.
I got to do more work on Payne.
Yeah. Because I think I love Sideways. Nebraska was great. I didn't love
The Descendants.
The Descendants was good.
I thought The Descendants was really good.
I thought it was really good. There, what was the one where Downsizing? I didn't love that one.
Oh, and that's interesting, because I actually really liked that.
I thought it was okay. I thought it kind of fumbled a little bit.
Because I think there's elements to there that similarly that we're talking about here. So that's interesting. That may be something we explore in a later podcast.
And I haven't seen The Holdovers yet, but Jess told me she loved it. So
I haven't seen that either. And I looked at that going, I need to watch it based on his portfolio. So yeah, he's definitely got what I love is, as a filmmaker, he's got his voice.
I love a consistent voice. I love knowing, I'm going to go see a Yorgos movie. I know
Yorgos, our boy, winning that.
I finally saw Poor Things too.
Not seen it yet.
You got to watch it, just because you're the only Yorgos fan that is like we are huge Yorgos Lanthimos fans. So I got it.
By the way, that came across us as a happenstance.
Yep.
Which was Netflix going, here's a recommendation of A Killing of a Sacred Deer. And then we watched it and did a podcast on it. And we both were like,
yes,
okay, this dude's the man.
And then we did the other ones too, right?
We did Dogtooth. We did Dogtooth and the Lobster.
Yes.
We didn't love Dogtooth, but we appreciated what it was trying to do. And for a new filmmaker, it was great.
Yeah.
We loved the Lobster. I did. So,
you got to watch Poor Things, because
I'll watch it.
We don't even have to talk about it on the podcast. I just dying to know your thoughts on it.
I'm in. I'm gonna watch it.
But anyway, my point is,
Payne's in our Hall of Fame, at least tentatively. We'll say tentatively in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And this is a new bar for us. I think I like this idea. We start categorizing, Hall of Fame or non, like, because we're both sports guys. We like basketball, and there's always these debates about, is that person good for the Hall of Fame or not?
Exactly.
And I don't want to become just a trash talker, but I'm going to put Payne in there right now and then watch the rest of his work. Cause Nebraska, Sideways, like, I think Election, now that we're breaking it down, like, there's some stuff here.
He's got some, I was going to say maybe like second ballot Hall of Fame, but he may be a first balloter.
There you go. That's the distinguishing factor. Do we go second or third ballot or first? No brainer.
I think he may be a first ballot. I'm going to go back and watch Nebraska, and I'm going to watch The Holdovers. Then I'll give a
defense. I think I got to watch The Holdovers and rewatch. I mean, Sideways is pretty good.
It's really good, man.
The Descendants I thought was really good. So he's in there. Maybe on the next one, we'll figure out, is this guy going straight into the Hall of Fame or not? We know Fincher's there.
Yeah.
So he's already in the Hall of Fame, and we'll keep moving with this idea. So
you have the Coen brothers obviously in there. I mean, they're that goes without saying.
That's from the first movie.
Yeah, that goes without saying.
Well, it's simple. You make that as your first movie, it's over, dude.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. We'll go through. Maybe that'll be like a...
That'll be one of our continuous themes, is like, are these guys Hall of Famers? We're going to Alan, we're going to create our own movie Hall of Fame.
That's it. That's it, man.
And we'll revisit our Mount Rushmore of actors just to...
Fuck the Oscars. We're just going to, we're doing the Hall of Fame, man.
Exactly, dude. We're going to start our own thing, and we're just going to make a Hall of Fame. We don't care about no Oscar.
Yeah, who cares about Oscars, man?
So many things going on here. We could keep going and going for the sake of people's time and attention. what's your rating on Election now that we've kind of talked it up? Now keep in mind here, I'm going to throw these out. We've got IMDb at 7.3. That's a pretty damn good rating. It's out of over 100,000 users.
It is.
Subscribers. So they're at 7.3. And then additionally, we have Rotten Tomatoes at 92%. And that's coming 92% from the critics. And then the audience only have it at 79.
It's disappointing. I wonder, I would love to know what people thought of it right after it came out, because like we said, the marketing, all of it, the trailers, the posters, everything, it looks like it's going to be a raunchy sex comedy.
Can I say this too, though, is that Roger Ebert, who was still alive at this time, gave it 3.5 out of 4. That's a pretty damn good rating.
That's really good.
And he says, here's a movie that is not simply about an obnoxious student, but also about an imperfect teacher.
You could say that.
A lockstep administrator and a student body that is mostly just marking time until it can go out to the world and occupy valuable space. That's actually a pretty funny movie.
Roger Ebert was a master craftsman of the American language.
And breaking it down in cinematic terms, and a master craftsman of cinematic analysis, I think.
The American language, the English language. Good God.
Did you say American there?
I think I said the American language. Oh, man. Just,
Freudian slip, I guess.
I should not be allowed to have a microphone.
But what I'm getting at is there's a lot of good reviews here. And what's crazy is, just so you know, accolades also include a nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay for the Academy Awards. So we said, fuck the Oscars, but nonetheless, we'll revert back to them for the time being.
Yeah.
Until the Hall of Fame gets big enough.
Exactly, yeah. Until we close on the building.
Yes. It got a nom for Best Adapted Screenplay. A Golden Globe for Best Actress, Best Feature, Best Direction. It won a Golden Globe. Best Screenplay. It won a Golden Globe. So, like, it actually...
Wow.
I didn't know that, now that I'm looking at this. That's pretty wild.
In a stacked year with Boys Don't Cry and The Insider and Being John Malkovich. And
They were nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. Whoa.
That's wild.
The critics loved it, is the point. The audience is not so much. Or not as much.
And again, I wonder if a lot of that is due to them thinking it was something else.
Yeah, they were going to get American Pie.
Yeah. I wonder how much due to that.
So where do you land?
Like I said, this is not one of my all-time favorite movies, but I love everything about it. So it's, I don't know, man. I love the direction, the acting, everything. I just thought it was great. I thought it was well put together and it was great. So I'm going to give it 8.5 Pepsis.
Oh, he's coming in hot, dude. That is a high ranking.
It is, especially for me.
For you. I've been known to give out some high rankings, but you, I wasn't expecting an 8.5.
But it's weird because it's not like we talk about rewatchability. It has rewatchability, but I'm not going to like revisit it all the time. I'm going to think back on it fondly, but it's never going to go on like a top 50 list or whatever, you know?
And you say that in Empire Magazine, which is kind of a big film industry magazine, they have it at 389 of the greatest 500 movies of all time.
Wow. Wow.
In Entertainment Weekly, for what it's worth, number 9 on best high school movies, which makes that I'm curious to see what the other ones are.
Wow. That's crazy.
So, I mean, it got accolades.
Yeah, but most audiences, I don't think, I would say most people don't really know about it or have any recollection of it existing.
Take this for what it's worth. According to Payne, it is also President Barack Obama's favorite political film.
Is it really? Wow.
I don't know what that says.
I can see politicians liking it. I can see that.
It's not necessarily a good representation, though. It's not saying that these are wholesome individuals.
No, I mean, exactly.
With the best interest in mind. So that's interesting that politicians might be.
I wonder if politicians view it and they're like, oh, that's based on so-and-so, or, you know, like they make it their own.
They don't, just like the characters.
Exactly. Exactly.
I love it. So you got 8.5.
Yep.
A lot of things going on here. A lot of things that I liked, the relationship dynamics between the teacher and the student. A lot of just moral dilemmas that are faced by the characters, which I thought were really well put together. I think we alluded to those pretty good. Humor. Let's not forget, like, the comedy, right? Like, it's funny.
It really is.
So I think it does that. And also, I think when you're addressing social or political issues, it can be hard to make sure that comedy hits. But I think he does a good job. So I'm going to go just a tad lower because these are areas where I'm a little more of a critic and less of an apologist,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to stay above 8.
That's still,
I know, but it's also part of our discussion here and also looking at it. I think it just covers so many broader issues that are present in our culture, in our society, and it's basically the inception of like a sex comedy.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm gonna go 8.1 voting ballots.
Yeah. Nice.
8.1 voting ballots.
It is in the book. Our scores have been recorded for all of eternity.
All of it, and they were not two of them were not thrown away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
And Alexander Payne is currently in our tentative Hall of Fame.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. He's definitely going in there. We just don't know what ballot.
What ballot Hall of Famer?
Yeah.
This is the Tame Aperture Podcast, Talking Election, written and directed by Alexander Payne. Or Alan, this is Gabe signing off with Tame Aperture Podcast. Thanks, everybody.
The Tame Aperture Podcast is produced by Dutch Angle Pictures in association with Studio B Productions. Listen, watch, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and YouTube.